And we turn now to our regular Friday political commentators, E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and David Brooks of The New York Times. Welcome to both of you.
Good to be here.
Good to be with you.
As we just heard from Sonari Glinton about the jobs picture, President Obama recently called out House Majority Leader Eric Cantor. He said that Cantor won't even let this jobs bill have a vote. There's a new poll out by ABC News and Washington Post that shows the president has a 15-point lead over Republicans in Congress in terms of who they trust to create jobs. David, what has changed for the president and for the GOP here?
Well, I think what we just heard in that report, which is that most people in the country see this as a very long, deep problem. After you get financial crises, you usually get 6 or 7 years of really terrible economics, multiple problems, as we just heard, low consumer demand, low business investment, people don't know what their houses are worth, political risks in Europe, one thing after another. And I don't think too many people have faith that a temporary payroll tax cut or a few small things in the jobs bill are going to make that fundamental a difference. And so what we should be working on is the fundamental things, the big tax reform, the big fiscal reform, that sort of thing. People understand that this is a really deep fundamental problem that probably can't be solved by something relatively small.
EJ, where do you think the president can go from here?
Well, I think the country is in a different place than David does on this. Yes, they think there are long-term problems here, and there are. But I think they look at what's happened over the last 6 months and say, we need to give the economy a jolt now. And I think that's why the president has finally been on the offensive against the Congress. I think calling out Eric Cantor by name shows he's got real confidence that what's actually in his jobs bill, including the payroll tax cuts, but also the investments in schools and teachers and roads, are all very popular things. Americans like government to do that, even when they say they don't like government very much. And so it's, 100,000 jobs today. I was worried David and I could be here 5 years from now and we wouldn't even get up to 100,000 jobs. That's good news for Obama. But A, it's got to get bigger. And I think he needs to show he wants to make it bigger. And that's why I think he's on the offensive on this.
Let's turn to the Occupy Wall Street protests that seem to be gaining some momentum. EJ, you wrote yesterday in your column that these demonstrations in New York and elsewhere, and I'm quoting you now, mark a shift on the progressive side from defense to offense. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, if we go back to 2009, the main power in American politics was on the right with the Tea Party. Americans are deeply skeptical of concentrated power. It's one of the good things about us. But the Tea Party was able to identify the concentrated power we needed to be afraid of as the power of government. But when you look at what happened, the economy is in this fix because a lot of people on Wall Street and in the financial community invented these very strange and, I think, irresponsible financial instruments that blew up. They made a lot of money in the meantime, and then the whole economy blew up. So what you have out there, finally, is a pull, if you will, on the left side, even though this movement isn't easily categorized ideologically, blaming Wall Street, not the government, and offering an alternative explanation for how we got into this fix. I think that begins to change the debate.
David, economist Joseph Stiglitz visited the protesters this week. President Obama, Vice President Biden have both been asked about it, both commented on it. Do you think it's gaining legitimacy or momentum, or is this a short-lived thing?
I suspect it's a short-lived thing. They've got some legitimate issues. The Obama administration should have broken up the banks. They're too big to fail, too big to manage. And the student loan issue is quite a legitimate issue. I think you should be able to declare bankruptcy on the student loan. The central flaw is, and it's parallel to what the Obama administration has said, the Obama administration said they'd never raise taxes on people in the 98 lowest percentile. One of the core themes of the Occupy movement is that it's 99% who are honest and 1% who are wrong. Well, that's just not true. If you want to know what the real problems with our economy is, the too much spending, too much mortgages, unwillingness to raise taxes on people, it's not just 99 versus 1%. The problem in spending is many middle-class Americans. The unwillingness to change Medicare and entitlements is many middle-class Americans. The unwillingness to accept sacrifice is many middle-class Americans. So you can't just throw everything off on the top 1%. We should be occupying ourselves.
Middle-class Americans didn't invent the financial instruments that blew up this economy. Middle-class Americans did not make a pile of money on these very strange derivatives. I think that the anti-Wall Street movement is drawing that line because because they're right, that the first and primary cause of this lay on Wall Street and in the financial community, while a lot of middle-class Americans were trying to do the right thing.
Average personal debt was 43% of GDP 20 years ago. Now it's over 130% of GDP. This was a problem that transcended. I agree with the Wall Street indictment, but this was transcended. And the idea that you can solve problems by ignoring the bottom 99%, just not possible.
Let's move on to the GOP presidential field now. David, former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie have both bowed out. They're not running. What do you think of the state of the GOP field now?
Boring. It's going to be Mitt Romney, it looks like, unless we get some sort of, you know, incredible weird thing happen. Romney is I don't know what the opposite of rats fleeing the ship. The rats are jumping on the ship. So he's getting the donors. He's getting the big intellects. He's getting the whole movement behind him. And to me, that's good news. He's got many of the smartest people in the Republican Party, people like Greg Mankiw of Harvard, people like Robert Kagan of Brookings Institution. They're his advisors. He's got real substantive heft now. He's sort of gathering the establishment. The Tea Party might not like that, but the establishment still means a lot. So he's got just tremendous momentum right now.
EJ, last word. Is Mitt Romney the one to beat now?
He is, and that creates a problem for him. Mitt Romney's great asset, and I'm waiting, by the way, for David to inspire rats for Romney bumper stickers. But his advantage is moderates aren't sure he believes all these right-wing things he's saying, so they'll vote for him. But conservatives aren't sure he believes the right-wing things he's saying. And so I think you're going to see the entire Republican field beginning with Rick Perry to try to go right at that contradiction and challenge Mitt Romney. So it might not be boring after all.
E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and Brookings Institution and David Brooks of The New York Times, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Melissa Block. A new jobs report today offers a glimmer of hope for the struggling economy. The Department of Labor says employers added 103,000 new jobs in September. That was enough to beat economists' forecasts, but it wasn't enough to change the unemployment rate. For the third month in a row, the jobless number is stuck at 9.1%. NPR's Sonari Glinton explains that businesses, especially small ones, are still cautious about hiring.
Phew. That's pretty much the sentiment of economists who wait for the unemployment numbers to come out each month.
Well, I think our initial response is a huge sigh of relief.
That's how Mark Vittner felt. He's senior economist at Wells Fargo.
There's been a lot of concern that maybe the economy was going to slide back into a second recession, and this should take some of those fears out.
The sectors that gained were construction, healthcare, and retail. The numbers were also helped by 45,000 Verizon workers who went back on the job after a strike. Meanwhile, manufacturing took a dip for the second month in a row. Vittner says, though, this is no time for a party.
There is little sign that conditions are improving for the long-term unemployed. The average duration of unemployment rose to 40.5 weeks. And when I look at that number and I think back over my lifetime, I never thought I would see a number that high.
Also today, PNC Financial Services released a survey that says 4 out of 5 small businesses will reduce or maintain their number of full-time employees over the next 6 months. Kim and Scott's Gourmet Pretzels has about 70 employees on Chicago's Near West Side. Kim Holstein is the CEO of the company. Her husband, Scott, is the president. Kim Holstein shows me the pretzel line.
Well, right now what we've done is these are our fully baked pretzels, and they're actually putting them on the line to pack them into 2-packs, and we put them in our boxes to send over to grocery stores in the frozen aisle.
Their pretzels can be found all over the country. Kim Holstein says as winter approaches, her business picks up. She's going to be hiring, but in a normal year, they may have added 20 workers. This winter, it'll be more like 10.
We have to be smart and careful. We have to make, you know, smart decisions where we're really conscious of, you know, do we have the business to hire these people? We don't want to hire a bunch of people and then lay them off.
Holstein's husband, Scott, says they've had to get creative.
What we've done, there are 3 senior positions that in the last year or 6 months, we switched from salaried employees full-time over to consultants. So the same person who was working full-time is now a consultant for us working part-time.
So what would make the Holsteins add more workers?
Demand really drives the hiring. So if we're just going to get a discount in, say, employment taxes, that's not necessarily an incentive. I mean, it's a little bit, it's nice, but it's not going to make us hire somebody. What makes us hire somebody is demand, you know, is needing to make more product.
Sean Harrington owns two bars in downtown Detroit. They're in about the best location for bars in Detroit, especially now. They're throwing distance from the stadium where the Tigers will play for baseball's American League Championship and the other stadium where football's Lions are undefeated. Harrington says things are good, but
in the businesses that we have right now, we're not adding anybody. We're just, if we lose somebody, we pick somebody else up. We're holding steady.
Harrington is 43. He's owned bars and restaurants in Detroit for almost 20 years. He says he's learned a pretty important lesson in these last few years. Stay lean.
If all of a sudden the cloud lifted on the economy and the European economy, the Greeks got their acts together and all the economies got better all over, I don't know if I would do things that much differently.
Harrington says he'll have to see a lot of customers in the seats for a long time before he goes on a hiring spree. Sonari Glenton, NPR News.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The Mars rover Opportunity just keeps on going. 7 years and 13 miles after a mission that was to last just a few months, the durable little robot has slowly crawled its way to the lip of a vast crater and has stumbled on a rock that looks like none yet discovered on Mars. Steve Squires is principal investigator of the Mars Exploration Rover Mission, professor of astronomy at Cornell University. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Squires.
Hi, Ira. It's nice to be back.
Nice to have you, Steve. Tell us what this crater is. It's a huge crater?
Yeah, it's big. It's named Endeavour Crater. It's named after James Cook's ship of exploration. And it's a big thing. It's, 25 kilometers, 15 miles or so in diameter. The thing that makes it interesting is that it's really old. This thing is older than anything that we've been driving around on for the past 7.5 years with the Opportunity rover. And the rim of this crater is kind of sticking up through the rocks that we've been driving around on and exposes some much older and dramatically different materials. It feels like a brand new mission. It feels to me like it started all over again.
Wow. And so this is, you're getting to the bedrock, would that be right to
say?
Yeah,
this is the most ancient bedrock that we have seen on this side of the planet.
And so when you say it feels like a new mission, that's because you're finding stuff you hadn't seen before.
Yeah, that's right. We're finding new materials. Now, I'll confess, there's a way in which it doesn't feel like a new mission. That's it. We've got a very old rover now. this rover is kind of old and tired and beat up, and we're making do with it as best we can. But the science is dramatically different over here, and it's fun. It's exciting.
Yeah. What's fun about this new rock that?
I'll be honest with you. We're kind of confused right now. And this is the way it always is when you get to some new material on Mars. We've experienced this several times now with both rovers, and we're still just kind of working this out. One thing that's clear is that we're seeing the signature of the big impact event that created this crater. These rocks clearly formed in a violent act. There was a big, big impact that formed. It broke rock up. It partially melted rock. It jumbled stuff together. We see rocks that are different from anything that we've seen with either rover so far. But they're similar in some ways to rocks that have been seen, for example, on the moon, where you've had a lot of cratering processes operate. The chemistry is different, though.
Anything similar to what we'd find on Earth?
Yeah, there are places, for example, there are places in some very ancient rocks in Canada, the part of Canada that geologists call the Canadian Shield. And there are places there where there are the remains of impact craters on Earth preserved, and we see rocks that just look like perfect dead ringers for some of the rocks that you see up there.
Yeah, so these rocks then are billions of years old.
Yeah. We don't, I wish I could tell you exactly how old they are, but we have no way of dating them. The only way to date them would be to bring them back. But they're really old. They are certainly the oldest ones that we've seen with this rover.
I remember when Opportunity started on this trip. I think you were on the show.
Yeah.
You said, oh, it's going to take a little journey. And I think I said, how long is it going to take? And you said, oh, a couple of years.
Yeah. And that's, I'm proud of that because that's almost exactly what it was. It was just about 2 years from when we were in this place called Victoria Crater, which seemed huge at the time. It was 800 meters across, half a mile in diameter. And we made the decision to set out for Endeavour Crater, and it just seemed impossibly far away. And I got to be honest with you. I mean, when I was on the show then, and I said, yeah, a couple years, I was only moderately confident that we were going to make it. I mean, it's a long, long drive. Like you said, it was 13 miles to get from Victoria to Endeavour, and that was a long haul. And it's astonishing that we actually made it.
And I remember we've been doing this over 7 years now. So
yeah.
I remember surprises about the durability of the rover. I remember saying, you know, solar panels have cleaned themselves off or something. Remember there was wind blowing them off and are they still doing that?
They don't clean themselves off. The wind doesn't.
Right.
We've had these lucky wind gusts that on multiple occasions have cleaned the vehicles off, and particularly Opportunity. The place where Opportunity is exploring turns out it's a pretty breezy place. And so those solar arrays have gotten cleaned off a number of times. They're kind of dusty right now, but we're hanging in there.
And you know, we keep seeing pictures from above, from the satellites going around. Is there any way that rovers, or now this last rover, can back up the speculation about water, you know, that they keep seeing? Can you see anything in the rocks that Opportunity is roving about on?
Yeah, I mean, you're limited by the nature of your landing site, right? We can only look at the rocks that are where we are. And the evidence for water that we have found with Opportunity is compelling, but it's not modern water. It's not water today. It's water in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And the places on Mars where they have found from orbit what looks like fairly strong evidence for possible water today, thousands of kilometers from where we are.
And there's planned another mission in November, December?
Yeah, there's a mission called MSL, the Mars Science Laboratory mission. The rover's name is Curiosity, and it's going to launch just after Thanksgiving and get to Mars the following August. That's an exciting mission. That's a big rover. It's nuclear-powered rather than solar-powered, so it won't have... You don't have to wait for a lucky wind gust to get your power fixed. That'll be nice. It's got some terrific science instruments on it. It's got the ability to look for organic molecules at the parts per gazillion level in the Martian rocks and soils and so forth. So that's going to be a really exciting mission.
Given that it's 7 years, that these rovers have been on, is there anything you learned from the construction or the composition of these machines that you could engineer back and say, we should do this better?
Oh, well, wait a second. Okay, so you're asking me if I would do things differently. You're going to give me more time and more money than we had, or I got to work with the budget I had?
Well, yeah.
Okay, if I had to work with the exact budget we had, I wouldn't change a single wire or a single screw.
No kidding.
They've worked so much better than any of us anticipated. I wouldn't dare change a thing.
Well, so then is this new baby just a bigger version?
Oh, no. This new baby learns from all of the things that we learned on this mission in terms of how to build it, how to operate it. But this new rover has a bigger budget, longer schedule, much more time and money to develop a really capable vehicle. And so it's got all kinds of capabilities that Spirit and Opportunity never had.
And where's the ideal place to set this down?
Well, the place that we're going with MSL is a place called Gale Crater. It's a terrific landing site. It's a big stack of layered sedimentary rocks. The rocks towards the top of the stack have a lot of sulfate salts, so they may have been produced when water evaporated away. The rocks at the bottom of the stack have a lot of clays in them, and clays form in the presence of water. And so these are sedimentary materials that really tell a compelling story of water in the past on Mars. You know, when you pick a landing site on Mars, you got a lot of things to consider. You got to think about the science, but you also got to think about the safety. I mean, if you don't land safely, you don't get any science at all. So the first thing is you've got to have a landing zone that is sufficiently smooth and flat that your landing system has a good chance of surviving.
All right. It sounds exciting. Well, we'll have to wait and see what happens. And
yeah.
There's no firm launch date yet, is there?
The launch date is going to be late November or maybe into early December.
Wow. All right. Steve, thanks for coming on. Sounds exciting. Well,
yep. Great to talk to you.
We'll wait for the next launch. And hopefully, is this rover, is Opportunity going anywhere next?
Opportunity, you know, I think we're going to spend the rest of the mission exploring Endeavour Crater. However long the rest of the mission is. Of course, I have no idea. It could be a week. It could be a year. It could be a decade. I don't have a clue.
Right. Why push your luck?
Well, it's a big crater. I mean, this thing's 25 kilometers in diameter. It's going to take us years.
It's like
to
the
explore
Grand
this.
Canyon, I would imagine.
It is. Yeah. It is. When you're a little rover, it's very much like that.
All right, Steve. Thanks a lot.
Take care.
Steve Squires, principal investigator of the Mars Exploration Rover Mission and professor of astronomy at Cornell University.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raj.
And I'm Melissa Block. We were tickled this week to read some tips in New York Magazine about fine wines and fancy cheese. It wasn't a story laying out the difference between the Brunello and Chianti grape or between goat and sheep's milk cheese. No, it was a set of tips for faking it as a food connoisseur. The advice came from someone who ought to know, Alton Brown, host of Iron Chef America on the Food Network, and he joins me now. Alton Brown, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
And first on your list, how to fake it as a wine connoisseur. What are your tips?
Well, you know, when you go into a restaurant, one of the scariest things is the wine list. So whenever I'm really feeling intimidated, I'll just pick a wine type, like a Chianti or a Brunello or a Burgundy, and I'll pick a year that's missing and ask for that one. And then when they try to off-sell me to another year, I debate that the weather wasn't very good that year and that maybe they could make another suggestion. You know, in the end, you have to remember that wine folks, you know, sommeliers are full of knowledge that they want to show off above all. So the goal is to let them show off while making it look like you kind of deserve their best act. And so asking harmless questions is always really, really good. And occasionally I'll make reference to having had several other bottles that I see on the list and then kind of let them go from there. So that makes it look like you know something that when you actually can't even pronounce the words right.
Okay, that's wine. What about cheese? How do you fake it with fancy cheese?
Well, the first thing you would do is if you can see the cheese, that's always good. You know, T.S. Eliot said, never consume a cheese without first having examined it, and I'm a really big proponent of that.
T.S. Eliot said that?
Yeah, he did. You can look it up.
You can
Google it. If you ask to see the cheese, that's always good, and it shows that you know enough to recognize quality of cheese. And then what I do is I say, okay, here's what I would love for you to do. Put together for me a cow's cheese, a sheep cheese, and a goat cheese. I want one that's firm, one that's only lightly aged, and one that's fresh. Can you do that? And they'll say, oh, well, certainly, sir. And then you say, but now I want them all to be American. Oh, and that'll just freak them out even more. So if you make it a riddle, that lets them show off their knowledge. So what I always do is I always order an odd number of cheeses because it looks best on the plate. I always ask for cow, goat, sheep, and I always ask one of them to be either blue-veined or wrapped in something mysterious looking like ashes because that just looks good on the plate.
Now, Alton Brown, you were named, if I have this right, Bon Appetit's Cooking Teacher of the Year in 2004?
Well, 2004 was a long time ago, but I do seem to remember that, yes.
Okay. Well, you would assume then that your preference would be that people actually learn stuff, know what they're talking about,
absolutely,
rather than faking it.
I would rather people actually learn. And there's absolutely nothing, unless you're really trying to impress somebody, there's absolutely nothing wrong with simply pleading, you know, ignorance in these situations. I only really fake it anymore with sommeliers who are being really snotty to me, and I don't want to take their grief. And so I try to do something to kind of throw them off or put them on the defensive, even if I don't know what I'm talking about.
We've been pretty highbrow on our list here, Alton. But what about your favorite lowbrow food that requires just no faking whatsoever on your part?
I'm an absolute connoisseur of cheeseburgers and like to think that I can detect even mere percentages of shift in fat content and ground meat in a burger and can actually name the temperature to which it was actually cooked to the degree if I'm really on my game.
If anybody really wants to know.
If anybody really, really wants to know. It just goes to show how many hamburgers I've had, specifically cheeseburgers.
And it could be that your friends are just faking their interest in hearing your stories about cheeseburgers.
Now, that's just something I didn't need to think about. Come on. Melissa, you didn't need to do that. I mean, now I'm just going to be paranoid every time I start talking about cheeseburgers. Thanks for that.
Sorry. Alton Brown, the host of Iron Chef America. He's also the author of Good Eats 3, The Later Years. Alton Brown, thanks. Buon appetito.
Buon appetito to you.
And one last thing. We did Google that cheese quote from T.S. Eliot that Alton Brown mentioned. For the record, it actually goes like this. Never commit yourself to a cheese without having first examined it. Words to live by.
As a child growing up on his family's farm in the 1980s, Jerry Gettle didn't spend his evenings watching TV. He read seed catalogs. To him, the endless varieties of seeds with exotic-sounding names were full of possibility. He loved the idea of planting them and eventually preparing the harvested vegetables for a family meal. From that early fascination with seeds, Gettle has built a thriving business, the Baker Creek Heirloom Seed Company. And now there's a book, The Heirloom Life Gardener. Gettle describes heirloom seeds as being passed down through the generations. They're usually more than 50 years old and are considered pure, not genetically modified.
They've basically been sitting in people's, you know, backyards and their garages and their root cellars. They've just recently been rediscovered for the market. I mean, in the last 10 or 12 years, all of a sudden, every chef and every magazine is all of a sudden starting to talk about our agricultural past. And with that comes, you know, the varieties that basically made America.
Well, you mention in your book that as a child, I think, or certainly as a teenager, when you were going through these catalogs, you started noticing that certain seeds were being left behind.
Yeah, probably about the time I was 10 or 12 years old, I started noticing seeds disappearing. That was, you know, the late 80s and early 90s. And especially the 80s was a period when varieties were just being dropped randomly from catalogs for no reason other than they weren't the newest thing. And so, you know, I started noticing things like the banana melon disappearing out of catalogs, which was an incredible melon. So it kind of inspired me to, you know, start looking for varieties.
Well, I think what's most striking about, you know, the vegetables that are grown from these heirloom seeds is how different they look from what we're used to seeing in a grocery store.
They vary from everything that looks like a traditional grocery store variety, but the majority of them are different looking. Each one's unique, as were the families they came from. I mean, there's varieties from, you know, African-American heritage here, Japanese varieties, German varieties, and each type comes with their own cultures, whatever they thought was greater, tasty, or good looking. So you have a lot of diversity.
What's the most interesting seed that you ever found? What's the most interesting story behind a seed that you discovered while you were traveling around the world?
Oh, there's so many different stories. And a lot of times, actually, when we're traveling, we don't get the full story because of language barriers. So some of them we've actually found, you know, online as well, like the Yokohama squash. It was one that was brought to the United States in the 1860s. And it basically had disappeared out of commercial catalogs in the 1880s. And we thought it was extinct, and we finally found a grower in France that was still preserving it. It's a beautiful flattened pumpkin-shaped squash with a beautiful gray-green rind, and it kind of has a waxy look to it. One of the best eating of all the different squashes that we grow.
Right. You can travel all over the world to find seeds, but you also in the book explain how you can save seeds in your own kitchen.
That's correct. As long as you're planting the traditional varieties that aren't patented, you can save seed. You know, almost anything you grow, you can save seeds from as long as it's traditional. It's very easy, actually. It's, you know, a process that nature does all every year.
You know, you mentioned in the book that you attended an auction where buckets of heirloom vegetables were being sold for like $1,000, as if they were sort of a work of art. Does that bother you at all to see vegetables treated as if they're kind of precious relics, as I think you put it in the book?
I think it's exciting, you know, to see that, you know, the support behind heirlooms. Anything to create awareness of where our food comes from, the varieties and the history behind it all is, you know, definitely anything that can encourage that we're for.
But do you want to put those vegetables in their place right back on the family dinner table as opposed to in an art house auction?
Definitely that's what we're behind, and that's actually what the auction was behind as well. It was, you know, to raise money and create awareness. It's definitely what's happening right now across America. I mean, farmers markets have, you know, tripled in the last 10 or 12 years in the United States. And fortunately for heirloom varieties, they've become kind of the stars at each farmer's market.
Jerry Gettle, he and his wife Emily are the authors of the new book, The Heirloom Life Gardener. Thanks so much for joining us, Jerry.
Thank you and have a great day.
You can find a list of Gettle's tips for how to save seeds in your own kitchen in an excerpt on our website, npr.org.
At the top of NPR's business news, a new low for mortgage rates. It's cheaper than ever to finance a home. mortgage rates have fallen below 4%, making the average 30-year fixed rate loan the lowest it's ever been. NPR's Wendy Kaufman has more.
The 30-year fixed rate now averages just 3.94%. Rates have been low or extremely low for the past year. But as Celia Chen, a senior director at Moody's Analytics, notes, those low rates, low housing prices, and affordability that's near an all-time high haven't done much to boost very sluggish home sales.
People don't have jobs, and without job opportunities, households are just not going to feel comfortable about purchasing homes. Income growth is also slow, and that's holding back demand. And then finally, it's still difficult to get a mortgage.
Credit standards are much tougher than they used to be. One more factor, many would-be buyers may be fearing that home prices may go lower still. The 15-year fixed-rate loan, a popular choice for homeowners wishing to refinance, also fell to a record low, 3.26%, though that figure doesn't include refinancing costs. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.